This is the Infotagent podcast, the vaccine to the disinformation virus. An internal Facebook report, suppressed by the company but leaked to the media, has claimed that 64% of people who joined extremist groups on the platform did so by following online recommendation tools from the company. Another internal report later stated, our algorithms exploit the human brain's attraction to divisiveness. The Reuters Institute at the University of Oxford has reported record low levels of public trust in the mainstream media, and the former Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, has now called for Facebook to promptly remove false viral information and to prevent political candidates and political action committees from using paid advertising to spread lies and misinformation. So, are we being dazed and confused by social media, or does it merely reflect divisions that already exist in our society? I'm Damien Collins, and I'll be discussing these and other issues with Roger McNamee, a Silicon Valley tech investor and former business mentor to Mark Zuckerberg, who has now become one of his biggest critics. In 2019, he published his book, Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, which led to the New Yorker magazine labeling him as Big Tech's big defector. We'll also be hearing from Adam Satariano, the technology correspondent for the New York Times, as well as our resident expert, the disinformation analyst, Dr. Charles Creel.
Roger McNamee, it's fantastic to have you on the Infotagent podcast. We've spoken many times about issues to do with social media and disinformation. Like so many other people, I greatly enjoyed your book, Zucked, which I think gives one of the best summaries of the issues that we face today. But of course, things keep on moving in this debate. And I wanted to start off by picking up on a comment that Mark Zuckerberg made before, which was referring to Facebook and Instagram as being like the digital town square. And I think looking at what's happening at the moment, the terrible civil unrest, the problems with fake news around COVID-19 and other important areas of public health, we have to question what sort of state this town square is in, because it seems to be one where conspiracy theories, fake ads, you know, voter suppression tactics, international interference in politics, all these things seem rife in this town square, and it doesn't seem to be a very healthy place to be.
Damien, I think that's exactly right, that the COVID pandemic really illustrates both the good and the bad of internet platforms. On the good side, it's hard to imagine how we would have handled social separation and quarantine as well without the benefit of products like Facebook and Instagram, which allowed us to keep touch with lots and lots of people. But quite obviously, in the United States at least, internet platforms, but in particular YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram, have fostered and nurtured extreme voices that have converted a national pandemic response into an element of the culture war. And that has been, in my mind, one of the most glaring examples of how the business model of Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and even Twitter are in conflict with the needs of society. And I'm hopeful that coming out of this particular moment, there will be a new understanding of the need to view internet platforms the way our society once viewed chemicals companies, say in the late 50s, or the pharmaceutical industry at the turn of the 20th century, or the building trades in the 19th century, where we recognized that these industries were so important to society, so important to our economy, that they could not be allowed to operate unsupervised. The chemicals industry was dumping toxic products anywhere without any cost. And that artificially inflated its profitability and its growth and damaged both public health and the environment in ways that ultimately resulted in regulation that changed incentives. And I'm very hopeful that coming out of this, Damien, we will see around the world a recognition that in order to get the good out of these platforms, we're going to have to make regulations that change the incentives of the business model and force the companies to operate in a way that's less toxic.
I think that's such an important point. And I think it's frustrating sometimes when if you question the business model of social media companies in particular and the way in which they're allowed to work at the moment, some people respond and say that's a kind of anti-tech point of view. And I think that's completely wrong, because it would be like saying that you're anti-car because you think seatbelts are a good idea. That there are things that were built into the way things work in society, which are for good, but it doesn't mean to say we're against the technology. It just means to say We want it to work in a better way.
When you don't have a good argument, you tend to resort to more childish ones like that. I think that you can see the inconsistencies really easily in Facebook's conversations with regulators about journalism in Europe versus the ones it's having with regulators in Australia. In Europe, there's an attempt to find some balance so that journalism can exist on Facebook. Whereas in Australia, where they want to impose effectively a tax, Facebook's going, no, we're not going to have any journalism on our platform at all. And I think what this really reduces to is Facebook is only willing to work with governments on Facebook's terms. And that position is really what we're debating today. Are these companies, which are larger than any individual country, are they in fact accountable to the countries in which they operate, or are they not?
And I was very interested last week in the move by Joe Biden as part of his presidential campaign in really laying down quite a big challenge to Facebook to do more to regulate political ads, to act against disinformation about the election being spread through the network, to make sure they enforce their platform policies properly on stopping messaging that could be maliciously designed to suppress voting. I mean, it would seem that Joe Biden clearly doesn't feel that enough has changed at Facebook since the last election. And clearly that he doesn't seem to think that just accepting what Facebook think is enough is good enough for him.
It's a great relief to hear him speak this way. In my mind, the most important message I could give to our listeners right now is to recognize that the current debate is about something called moderation, this notion that a combination of artificial intelligence and human moderators are going to be responsible for removing hate speech and disinformation and conspiracy theories from these platforms. I believe that that is a false framing of the problem. I do not believe that moderation can work on platforms like Facebook, like Instagram, like YouTube, even like Twitter. And there are three reasons. First, because the platforms are huge and the scale creates just an almost insurmountable problem. But there's also an issue of latency. So a way to think about this is when you post something, if a human moderator or even artificial intelligence is going to remove it, there will be a lag time between when it's posted and when the removal can take place. And a lot of damage can happen in that time. But the third and most important issue for moderation is the intent of these platforms. Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram have all made it clear that their bias is very strongly to permit as much speech as possible. Their goal is not actually to remove hate speech, disinformation, and conspiracy theories, because that is the most valuable content for engaging the emotions of their audiences, which is what drives their profitability. What they will do, if pressured sufficiently, they will remove an individual perpetrator, say an Alex Jones in the United States, the conspiracy theorist whose videos were recommended 15 billion times by the algorithms at YouTube. They will do that, forced to do so. But all that really does is allow thousands of other conspiracy theorists to replace Alex Jones, because the model is designed to promote that kind of content. And so the real conversation we need to have, Damian, and the real one that I hope Vice President Biden will have, both in the campaign and if he's elected, is in going after that business model, the algorithmic amplification of content. And I recently wrote something for Time Magazine in which I made the point that the core regulation in the United States that has been the safe harbor for these platforms, that allowed them to operate this way, is something called Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. And it was created to enable platforms to do moderation without legal jeopardy. What they've chosen to do instead is no moderation, and courts have interpreted the law as an absolute protection. And I believe what we need to do is to recognize that if you are using algorithms to amplify content, if you're not treating all content identically, that in that context, you would not have the protection of the safe harbor. So to the extent that you treat all content exactly the same, no problem. But if you're going to amplify one kind of content over another because that's good for your business, that's a choice that should remove the protections. There's going to be a huge debate over this. And to keep in mind, this is only one step. We still need to have privacy protections. We still need to have antitrust because these guys are too influential and too dominant in our economy. But going after the business model is an important step. And because of the politics in the US right now, this is something that was unthinkable 3 months ago that right now is, you know, changes to Section 230 are something we can actually consider for the first time. And to me, we need to press that as hard as we can to try to make that happen, because it would be the single most valuable thing to do to protect democracy and public health.
I think it's such an important debate. And indeed, we've started in the UK to start talking about Section 230 a little bit, because obviously, well, I have a concern that if the UK-US trade deal is based on the trade deal that was done with Mexico and Canada, then there could be an attempt to force those safe harbor provisions and in Section 230 onto the UK, which I think would make it impossible to do many of the things we want to do in terms of creating an effective system of regulation around social media and dealing with the most harmful forms of content. But from your article in Time, what I took from that was that the reason that you feel that safe harbor, changing the laws on safe harbor, is so important is because unless there is a requirement in law for the companies to behave in a different way, that they won't, and they will exploit safe harbor really just to make whatever decisions suit them as a business before acting any further.
That's absolutely correct. And we now have 15 years of evidence that that strategy is not only their preference, it works. And so they will continue to do it. I really want to encourage you to fight the extension of Section 230 to any trade deal with the United Kingdom. And I want to make a simple point about this. Google, Facebook, Twitter all want to automate absolutely every business process. And as a result, their practices reflect the stickiest parts of regulation in each jurisdiction. So when any country makes a change that restricts their behavior, they wind up applying that globally because it's cheaper than trying to respond individually in every country. And so I'm extremely hopeful that every country will do something. And you can each do something different. We do not need a global coordinated response here. Because of the nature of the business model, having random activities in different cities and states and countries will produce a very desirable outcome from the consumer's perspective. And it is my great hope that in Europe, the differences we've seen between the United Kingdom's focus and that in Germany or France, I hope you will all continue to focus in the areas of your greatest interest and strength, because at the end of the day, any change is likely to work out well. And I want to make this point really aggressively, which is that I am very pro-technology and I'm very pro-economic growth. And I believe that having the industry monopolized as it is today is extremely harmful, and that it is stifling innovation. It is stifling entrepreneurship. And if we want to revive those things, we need to create space for startups to succeed. And that currently does not exist.
Absolutely right. And I just wanted to ask, I want to bring Adam into the discussion as well. But before I do, just one final question I want to ask for the moment is, you obviously, you know, you've known Mark Zuckerberg, Sheryl Sandberg for a long time. You know, would consider yourself, I think, probably a friend, an advisor, a mentor to the company in its early days. And you're now someone who speaks out about the business model of Facebook and other similar companies. It would seem that there are more people, both current and former employees of Facebook, who again are raising concerns about the way the business works and the way the business operates. And I just want to know, you know, for the people you talk to, maybe the people you talk to privately, do you feel there is growing concern within the company about some of these issues? And also, I was particularly interested in some reporting about some research work done within Facebook that suggested that the platform is helping to radicalize opinion in society, and whether that's something you've heard about as well, and whether you had any views on that.
So the internal report, let me start with that. So that report was done post the U.S. election in 2016. It was very extensive. I believe a multi-year study. And it was squashed by the political operatives inside Facebook, the Washington office, for very simple reasons, that it revealed that Facebook was largely an unhelpful force in U.S. politics, that it was increasing polarization, that 64% of the joins of the times when people would join an extremist group were the consequence of a recommendation made by Facebook. And so that kind of thing suggests exactly what I've been worried about. And Facebook suppressed the report. It leaked out. Again, that was really conspicuous because the company has been very effective at preventing leaks historically. But the last 12 months have seen employees pushing back for the first time. So they didn't push back after Brexit. They didn't push back after the 2016 U.S. election. They didn't question Facebook's policies in Myanmar that enabled a genocide. They didn't question the policies that essentially incentivized the terrorist in Christchurch. But they are focused now, and that is very positive. There were a few hundred people who did a virtual walkout a couple weeks ago over Facebook's handling of the Trump messages, the ones that effectively had been restricted by Twitter, were not touched by Facebook. That pushback is unprecedented. I would encourage you not to have great expectations for things coming out of it. Tech companies have a lot of tools for suppressing dissent. But the fact that any showed up at all is a positive thing. And I'm extremely hopeful that it is the beginning of something that over a period of time will give us leverage, because there's no group of people with more power to change the values of Google and Facebook and Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, than the employees who work there. They have a ton of leverage, and historically they've not used any of it.
Yeah. But I'd just like to ask for your views on one of the issues we just discussed with Roger, and that's sort of Joe Biden's sort of trying to make Facebook an issue in his campaign. Do you feel that these issues around the way social media companies are run, the impact their tools have on society, do you feel this is a debate which is now in the mainstream and could even be an election issue in America?
I do. It's been stunning to see. I mean, I sort of come at this from a different perspective than you two. You know, I'm not an advocate for regulation or no regulation. I'm not pro or anti Facebook. I've sort of been covering it as a news story over the years. And when I started covering technology about 10 or so years ago, it was just an incredible amount of kind of euphoria around all that was being created. The iPhone had just come out. The App Store was gaining momentum. And how things have evolved, and particularly over the past 6 to 12 months, has been really remarkable. And that a a leading presidential candidate in the Democratic Party, which has traditionally been very, very cozy with Silicon Valley, is calling for these sorts of changes, is a really stunning change. And you see it throughout Washington in a way that you haven't before. Usually it's been regulation has come from Europe, and there's been an undertone of it that it was sort of an anti-American attempt or a way to hamstring American companies, fairly or not. That's how it's characterized by many in the United States. But now you see action in Washington where they're taking many of the same steps and they're communicating with one another. And to see the different laws under consideration in the UK and elsewhere, and the antitrust investigations that are going on in Brussels and Washington from different states' attorneys general, it's really a groundswell. And what it comes to remains to be seen, but I think even the energy and momentum that you're seeing around it has to be changing the way these companies are behaving. And so that's something, just as a reporter, that I'm watching for, to see if there are ways in which some of this external pressure and internal, as Roger rightly points out, the way that the employees are organizing themselves is really fascinating and something that's very, very unique. And so all these things are sort of being whirled together in this stew, and the companies are just under a tremendous amount of pressure.
Do you think that COVID has played a factor in this? Because obviously the world has gone through the most extraordinary 5 or 6 months, and I think I sort of feel with regards to disinformation that actually in a public health emergency the public interest in that is much greater because they want to know what's going to keep them safe and what might protect them from the virus. I think the extraordinary response to we've seen through the Black Lives Matter movement and the response to that, and indeed the protest against it as well from some people too. Social media has played a really important role in that messaging. Do you feel that's given people a heightened sense of the importance of these issues over the last few months?
I don't know to cop out with that with this answer. The it is very hard to tell how much, as a sort of a general voting issue, this issue is for voters. I think there are certain things that have broken through that have usually been tied to broader politics and the polarized views about Trump in general. So Cambridge Analytica was a story that really changed the debate, but more than a story about the data collection practices that were going on for years and years and years. I mean, Obama campaign officials were put on the cover of magazines for the similar sorts of tactics. But what was happening is that this was around the Trump election, which really polarized the issue and made people very angry. And I think you're seeing a similar dynamic now with what's happening with Mark Zuckerberg and some of the criticism that he's facing as a result of not taking a stronger stand against some of the comments that Trump has posted on social media in the same way that has happened with Twitter. And so it's very hard to tell. I don't know if COVID is an issue that, you know, the social media company's reaction to the pandemic is something that's going to be top of mind for somebody going into vote in November. I mean, the issues are going to be the economy and things like that. So, but there's no doubt that this is an issue that is much more at the fore than it was a year or 2 years ago.
Yeah, Damien, I would like to both make a small comment, but also ask a question to Adam to follow that up.
Yeah, of course.
So, Adam, what strikes me is that by essentially enabling the politicization of public health, of converting masks and social distancing into elements of the culture war, Facebook in particular has left itself vulnerable in the American political system because the group of people that historically were most supportive of tech, which is to say Democrats, are for the most part hyper aware of the role that social media is playing in the quarantine liberation movement and the anti-mask and anti-government policy things. So it seems to me that it will may be a background issue. It may not be the thing that drives it, but I'm curious, when you talk about the economy, the pandemic's impact on the economy is really huge. And I'm curious whether you think people are going to not make the connection if the economy is in a bad shape in November between, you know, the pandemic and therefore Facebook's impact on the pandemic and that economic situation.
I don't necessarily. I think your point is a correct one, which is putting the sort of what's driving people to make the sort of voting decisions that they make. Putting that sort of aside, your point I think is absolutely correct that the influence that these platforms are having, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, especially, is weighing on the policymakers who ultimately are going to be the ones making the decisions about the companies. And some of the misinformation related to COVID has been interesting to watch, but almost feels like a warm-up act right now for what is to come if there's an eventual vaccine. I mean, the anti-vax crowd online is only growing. And you get to a point where there's a vaccine, there's going to be a loud contingent of people online who have become very skilled over the past number of years of using Facebook and other social media. And it's going to be there in their moment. And I'm very interested to see how that plays out in the months ahead, hopefully months before there's a vaccine, but who knows. I think those are issues that are going to be top of mind for policymakers as they think about how to regulate these companies.
Adam, there's a final question for me before we come to Charles. Rod used the expression culture wars earlier on, and I think you seem to hear that a lot now. You know, people talking about that there is a culture war between different tribes, and social media is where they fight each other, and that if something controversial happens, it's not just that people are individually talking about it, but there are suddenly swarms of accounts, particularly on Twitter, amplifying messaging and amplifying hate a lot of the time as well. I think there's been a kind of coarsening of the debate on a lot of these issues and increasing amount of aggression towards people that have a view or take a position on these different issues. And indeed, as a journalist, I mean, it seems that the phrase we now hear all the time, the mainstream media have been sucked into this as well. And I know the New York Times is one of President Trump's favorite targets, but do you feel there is a kind of, that journalism itself has become part of the culture war?
Of course, unfortunately. I think that journalistic organizations have been are being targeted like never before. There was just a horrifying decision today out of the Philippines in which a journalist was found guilty for libel in a case that was really an attempt to stifle her criticism of the government. And that's going to continue. Social media and the internet has given a megaphone to a lot of this debate. But I think it's part of a broader dynamic as well. I mean, there's some of this stuff has been going on for years and years in the United States with Fox News and things like that. So feeding on polarization and people's fears like that is not necessarily new to Facebook, but it has taken it to a higher level. I'd be curious what Roger thinks.
Roger, go on.
I think that the challenge that we face in the United States, at least, is that we have lost the ability as a country to have debates on substantive issues that matter to all of us, that essentially everything is pushed into a tribal war. And I don't think that there's anywhere for internet platforms to hide on this issue. Their business model is based on creating emotional conflict. And that is what's driving the politics in the United States, which are, in my opinion, dangerous today, in that the country is more or less given up on fighting a pandemic, which is still killing roughly 1,000 people a day. And it's affecting our ability to operate the economy. And, you know, the notion that just going back to work is going to solve everything, I think, is probably unrealistic, because many people are legitimately fearful of re-engaging in a normal life. And our politics aren't set up for dealing with that. And it's almost as though COVID came along and was engineered to expose the weakest elements of our political system, of our economy, and of our healthcare system. And so everything is failing simultaneously. And that is coming after roughly a 10-year period where the conflicts on social media were undermining expertise, were undermining institutions of all kinds. And so it's almost as though social media told us, well, these things were going to fail us at a critical moment, and then they did. And now the question is, what are we going to do about it? And what's delightful, Damien, in the United States is we're in Europe, many of the protests that are taking place have had a violent element to them. In the United States, they are predominantly peaceful, and they are extremely diverse. And the result of that is that one could imagine that a moment is happening now, analogous to what happened in the 60s in the civil rights movement around the Selma March and other individual things that wound up playing a key role in changing the national conversation and leading to the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. And it's not crazy to imagine we're going through one of those moments again. I think it's too early to know for sure, but social media is going to, if that change is taking place, social media is going to have a hard time politically in that environment, because it, while it has all these good elements, if you push power to a more democratic model in the United States, if decisions are made by the masses as opposed to a small number of elites, the internet platforms are going to suffer in that environment, because they are clearly part of the elite. And it's too early to know that that's what's happening, but things that were unimaginable a month ago happen routinely right now in the United States. And as somebody who's lived long enough to have seen the 60s, I'm stunned and optimistic, because, you know, it's easy to be cynical, but I would like to believe that we are going through a moment here, and that one of the consequences of that will be that when we apply that to technology, we will democratize that also, and that we'll look for other business models, we'll have a different value system, and that will lead to 1,000 flowers blooming. And a return to the model of technology is something that empowers people as opposed to something that exploits their weaknesses.
I think it's an interesting argument, and I think going back to what you said earlier, looking at other industries, about how as industries became important and played a dominant role in our lives, we also considered the harm they did and they were regulated. Because you could make a similar point about the media. I mean, I think, you know, the radio became an incredibly powerful tool politically in the 1930s. I think it was Goebbels who said that the Nazis couldn't have come to power without radio and the aeroplane. And in the late 60s, the, you know, satellite broadcast television that relayed images of protests from around the world into every living room in the land was considered, thought to play a very important role in spreading ideas and messages at that time as well. And of course, what happened in some ways with both those industries is that we recognized the tremendous power that broadcasting had, and therefore codes of practice were created around those broadcasters to make sure that they use that power responsibly. And therefore, whether it'd be interesting to see whether if it's felt that social media has played a role in radicalizing and dividing society, that we similarly will look at the ways in which we can make people hold that power, the companies themselves, more responsible for how they use it.
From your lips to God's ears, my friend.
Well, that sounds like an appropriate moment to bring in Charles Creel. And Charles, as our regular guest on the podcast, you keep a keen eye on the topical issues of the day. What's caught your eye over the last few days?
Thanks. Well, there's a couple of different stories that have come to mind, and in both cases, they've come to me directly through people that I know rather than people who I may know. First, I've had reports from West Sussex, from friends there, that print copies of a newspaper called Epoch Times have been pushed through their letterboxes completely unsolicited. It's a slick newspaper, it's expensively printed, and it's filled with hard right conspiracy theories that typically support Trump and just the Chinese government. In this particular issue, making the rounds around Ader, the coronavirus is being blamed on the Chinese Communist Party, and the paper suggests that it should be renamed the CCP virus. The paper is the work of the Epoch Media Group. It's a New York-based television and print operation, and they serve as kind of extension of the Falun Gong religious movement. That's a persecuted religious minority in China and a favorite target of the Chinese Communist Party. But in Europe and North America, they promote far-right political ideology, and they're not insignificant. They're the second largest funder of pro-Trump Facebook advertising after the Trump campaign. And in April of 2019, their social video views totaled 3 billion views. That ranks them 11th globally amongst all video creators. So why now West Sussex? Well, it seems like it's just their turn. Local media have reported a rise in distribution of Epoch Times in South Oxfordshire, Sheffield, Peterborough, and Scotland, all in the UK. There are regular stories in Canada of outraged locals finding the paper in their post, and the paper is distributed across the US. Something to keep an eye on, no matter what your politics, as it's clearly part of a larger campaign to sway public opinion around China and around COVID. And then the second story is in the middle of a lot of frustratingly negative disinformation surrounding the Black Lives Matter movement. I'd like to just shine a light on a really impressive campaign happening on Instagram. Most of us know George Floyd was killed by a police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota last month. A policeman knelt on his neck for more than 8 minutes, killing him, and the entire thing was caught on video, and we're seeing the results of that on the news every night. One of the more horrendous parts of this, though, is the video itself. In it, Floyd is pleading for his life. He begs others to help him, and it's to no avail, and it's unbelievably heartbreaking. But it's also nearly impossible to watch for most people who have a healthy sense of empathy. It's really hard to get through. I couldn't myself. And so the video, it becomes a kind of weird stain on our conscience. You know it's there, but you can't watch it, but you're compelled to. And then it somehow becomes unreal and uncanny. But artist Kara Walker has created a video work around George Floyd's death, and it resonates around this whole thing. UK listeners will know Kara created the last installation at Tate Modern's Turbine Hall. And in this new piece, she transcribes Floyd's words in the video and projects them onto a wall at the corner of Washington Avenue and Park in Brooklyn. Please, I can't breathe, he says. Please, ma'am, please somebody help me. It's a really powerful piece of work, but even more relevant here, it's gone viral on Instagram, and a video of the projection itself is what is causing so much excitement. And I think it's because it gives us a way to feel the pathos and brutality of this man's murder. It's also a really great example of how art, even online, can take something that's unbearable to behold and render it in a way that creates understanding and real sympathy. So I'd recommend everybody seek it out. It's by Carol Walker.
Thanks for that, Charles. We certainly will. Before we close, I wanted to just to give out calls to everybody about the sort of the future. And a lot of what we focused on here are some of the shortcomings of in particular social media and the radicalizing effect it can have on society. But if you're an optimist, you might say, well, will the companies respond to public pressure for this to work in a different way? Or will they gravitate towards new tools and new services that are less intrusive, gather less data, respect more people's privacy? And I wonder, Roger, Adam, Charles, whether you feel there are any positive signs to look out for at the moment.
Well, speaking as somebody who's been an advocate on this issue for the last 4 years, I do not think it's realistic to expect the companies to voluntarily change themselves. I have enormous optimism today because I think that the political will to impose change is increasing and has hit a threshold level of public engagement that is new. We just have not been here before. And it gives me great hope, particularly in Europe, where I think the values related to privacy and related to self-determination have more weight in politics than they do in the United States. The thing that makes me excited is that the focus of Google and Facebook and Twitter and Microsoft and Amazon is very narrow in terms of technology. And the result of their dominance is that countless opportunities that we could be realizing with technology are currently unexplored. And I'm hopeful that with a regulatory program to limit the impact of the largest companies, we will unleash a creative frenzy globally, because it's no longer necessary to be in Silicon Valley to participate. Anyone can do this anywhere in the world. That it will look like what happened with the antitrust cases in the United States against AT&T in 1956, IBM in 1964, and Microsoft in the 90s, where each time the U.S. regulated tech, it spurred massive innovation and massive entrepreneurship with great benefits to everyone. And I'm more optimistic about that today, Damien, than I have been at any time in my activism, which is not to say that we're there yet, but simply to say that I have an optimistic outlook, and I'm particularly excited for what I think is going to happen in Europe.
That's great.
I think that Roger's absolutely right. And, you know, social media companies are having their seatbelts moment, is the way that I tend to think about it. And, you know, they can either be the auto industry right now and go along, or they can be the tobacco industry. And so we'll see how that turns out. But what has me really excited is how people have poured into the streets now. I just think it's an incredible movement that has begun. And it's because folks are unemployed, and it's because people have been locked up at their houses for a long time, and folks have been living in fear for the last 3 months. Many different social conditions have come together to create this moment. But it's an incredible moment. And as Roger said, there's a lot of diversity in these crowds, and there's a lot of empathy in these crowds. And maybe if we're really very lucky, as a global society, we're entering a moment where empathy is king.
I've been struck during the current moment is the role that social media is playing. I mean, what has been incredibly powerful. You were talking about the video, for instance, of George Floyd. That ability to be able to be shared in the way that it was, it had people in every corner of the world have the ability to bear witness to what happened. And so, you know, the power of social media and these platforms remains really stunning when it's turned into a force for change. And so I'll leave to the historians to work out whether or not the role that social media and the internet played in pushing forward what's happened. But I think it's been quite significant. And so I think that I find that quite fascinating and really something to behold.
Adam, if I could ask just one last question before we wrap up. I mean, how confident are you about the future of news in the age of social media? Because I know the New York Times has been, you know, quite successful in its commercial growth in recent years. Do you feel that big news organizations will still thrive in this current climate? Or there are many people who've said, of course, that the economic shock of coronavirus may also finish off a lot of news companies.
I think it's a very precarious moment for our industry. I think the New York Times has done well for the moment, and I'm thankful for that. But I'm also worried about it having just one big news organization and all these others struggle. I mean, the Washington Post is doing well. The Wall Street Journal is doing well. There are a lot of news organizations that are doing well, but my bigger concerns are the big newspapers in different states around the United States. You're also seeing those challenges in Europe as well. What ultimately I remain hopeful in a big believer in journalism, because I genuinely believe that humans as sort of a species have a thirst for information. And I think that there will be a demand always for accurate reported information so that people can have the facts. And so that's why, it's sort of philosophically, I'm optimistic, but in terms of the business models of that and the dynamics that we as an industry are dealing with, it is very, very scary. And I think people do not take it seriously enough. I believe that a weakening press is a weakening democracy. And I wish that the general public could, I wish that we as an industry did better of conveying that to the general public. And it's something that we need to do a lot of soul searching about, in a way that we can communicate and interact with the public where we're trusted more, and that we can want people to buy subscriptions and see us as people who are aimed to provide the truth.
Damien, so can I add one short thing to that?
That's my soapbox. That's my spiel.
let me add one brief thing to this, because this is a project I'm actively working on. So I believe that the core issue is that journalism in the United States and in many parts of Europe has allowed itself to become captive to the attention economy of Google, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitter, of course. And in that process, imagine this. I believe that those platforms are designed to promote much different kinds of content. So it effectively devalues journalism to the point of irrelevance. Journalism is no more successful on Twitter or on Facebook or YouTube than it would be on Pornhub. It's just the wrong place for it. And the most important thing to do is to get the industry away from the focus on clicks, away from the focus on attention, and back to focusing entirely on journalism matters. I totally agree with Adam on this point. We need to remind everybody, journalism is not something that you capture, you know, between photos of cats. This is something that as a citizen, you're responsible for, you know, informing yourself a little bit every day. And getting it off the attention economy, I think, is a necessary step for rebuilding the whole thing. And in the United States, our situation is perilous because we have news deserts in almost essentially all but a few cities in the country. And it's really undermined our democracy.
I think it's a really important point on which to finish. And I think we've got to be really careful that news doesn't end up becoming a sort of premium product that a few people pay for, but that for many others, they will just get information through the swirl of social media, where an editor has effectively just been replaced by an algorithm. And that would be
stop that.
To be. I agree.
Yeah. It's been a fantastic discussion. Thank you so much for joining us and on the Invitation podcast. And I wish we had more time, but I think we have to draw it to a halt there. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Infotagent podcast, hosted by me, Damien Collins, featuring Roger McNamee, Adam Satoriano, and Charles Creel. It was produced by Lucy and David Dargahi. You can find out more about Infotagen, the independent COVID-19 fact-checking service recommended by Ofcom, and send us examples of disinformation you've seen by visiting our website, infotagen.com, or using hashtag isolatethelies on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you. Until next time.